listening to Shop Talk with your host, Kevin Tates. Brought to you by Eastwood Tools. Everything you need to do the job right.
Hey, gearheads, you're listening to Shop Talk, brought to you by the Eastwood Company. I'm your host, Kevin Tates. Well, today, we get to speak with one of the most familiar faces in the off-road industry, Mr. Ian Johnson, host of Extreme 4x4 on Spike Network. Now, Ian didn't get his start with a silver spoon in his mouth. He cut his teeth like the rest of us, turning wrenches in his driveway. He became a dealership mechanic, a certified mechanic, a high school shop teacher. He was a guest on a national TV show with Jesse James, and he's the host of Extreme 4x4 on Spike. Now, Ian's got the heart of a teacher, and he's willing to pass on his skills, and he gives us some cool tips on entry-level wheeling, how to get into a hobby that doesn't really take much money to perpetuate in the beginning. It's a cool sport. Ian's a nice guy, and he shares a little bit of light about what's not only coming next for him, but some pieces of the industry that we all need to pay attention to. So listen up to the conversation with Ian Johnson. You're listening to Shop Talk, brought to you by the Eastwood Company. Eastwood, makers of fine tools and automotive equipment. Do the job right with Eastwood. Well, I wanted to talk to somebody that gets dirt under their fingernails, that can give you good advice on getting out and getting dirty and off-roading. Also somebody that's no stranger to being in the media, either with magazines or television shows, and somebody that can find their way around a shop and around a toolbox. You know, it's kind of a rare combination of guys, but we've got one. This is Ian Johnson. You may know him from the Extreme 4x4 show, but a couple of other things. He has his brand and his face on. Ian, thank you for taking some time out of your day and talking with us today.
That's no problem, Kevin. It's always good to talk to you, buddy.
Well, let's get right to it, man. You know, of course, it's right up your alley to go wheeling, you know, and you build ridiculous, outrageous, awesome rigs on the show. And sometimes, you know, you and I have the privilege of doing these TV shows and being first to see brand new products and really cool stuff. And we get the opportunity to install them on vehicles, you know, without having the burden of writing the check for them. But that's not the case with everybody. And you know, we talk about this at work sometimes. You know it. I know it. We're lucky. We're fortunate to do what we do. But for somebody that just wants to get out there and bang around a little bit, let's talk about wheeling. How do you get started?
Well, that's probably the coolest thing about off-roading in general. It's that you can go wheeling, you know, with no money at all. There's guys out there, you hit the trails, you'll see guys with $1,000 trucks. You know, they'll go buy an old full-size Chevy truck, mid-80s, or even a Dodge with a good solid axle front, and they'll pull the diff cover off, weld up the spider gears, get a locker in the back, and just start wheeling it. And, you know, you can get out there and have, honestly, just as much fun for $1,000 as you can have for $25,000. And the coolest thing is you won't be discriminated upon at the off-road park because you show up with a $1,000 truck. Everyone gives just as much credit to those trucks as they do to the super high-end tube buggies. And that's kind of what I really dig about hardcore off-road.
Well, that speaks to the whole automotive hobby and industry. You know, it's guys that really honestly care. And if somebody's out there giving an effort, yeah, if they break an axle, you get under there and help them. If somebody's got a welder on their rig, of course you can use it. That's the cool thing about the off-road industry.
Yeah, and the neat thing is the guys will go out there, and it's just progression, right? It's just like any other part of the automotive aftermarket. You start at the bottom, and you'll end up working your way to the top. But some of the coolest rigs are not the rigs that guys have dumped tons of money in right off the bat. It's guys that they've progressed. So they've started with that $1,000 truck, and maybe they blew up the transfer case. So they ended up stepping up and dumping the money into a good aftermarket transfer case. And then they've blown the axles out. So then they step up to a chrome moly set of axles, or maybe even an actual selectable locker. But in the end, it's seat time in that truck that makes them a better off-roader. So if they just keep modifying the same vehicle, they'll be able to do stuff that guys who roll out there with a $25,000, $30,000 Jeep, they won't be able to get up that obstacle, and this guy will make it look easy because he's wheeled it probably harder than most guys have in their life.
Yep, because there's less financial investment, so it's easier to fix coming off the line. But the one prerequisite is that you got to be able to turn wrenches.
Yeah,
right?
That's the biggest thing is you start off-roading, you can start green, but you'll learn fast because
Yeah.
You know, if you break in the woods, it's you who's got to get your junk out of there. And yeah, guys will help you out, but it's still going to be you laying in a puddle trying to rig a drive shaft together to get your rig back to the park, back to the off-road park and back on your trailer. So you learn, and it's a steep learning curve, but when you learn well and you learn fast.
Well, and on top of that, you get empowered by it. You get a sense of accomplishment because you did a trail fix. You got yourself out of trouble, and that just goes back into the backpack as more ammunition. You're ready for the next time, and that gets built upon.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I always say that, you know, you're not really a real car guy can trail fix his car on the side of the interstate, which I've done. You know, and that you learn that, and you learn what's going to get you 100 feet and what's going to get you 1,000 feet. You know, I've ran into guys on the trail who they've broken a leaf spring bolt and they stuck a piece of all thread through it and put a set of vice grips on one end just to keep the leaf spring located. That set of vice grips is still on there 4 or 5 wheeling trips later. And the guys, and you know, their theory is, well, it's holding, it's fine for now. And when it breaks again, I'll actually put a bolt in it.
I love it. I love it. Well, let's go back in time a little bit. You know, speaking of being able to turn wrenches, you obviously pick this stuff up from somewhere. We all get our start. We all have our mentors. We all have our influences. Where did Ian Johnson learn how to not only turn wrenches, but where did you get your passion for doing this?
I blame it all on my first car. You know, if I had been one of those kids whose parents bought them like a brand new, now this was in the 80s, so it would be a 1985 Honda Civic like every kid my age wanted in the 80s, I would not be a mechanic today, because my first car was a $500 Volkswagen Bug that did not run. And if I wanted to drive to school, I had to fix that car. And, you know, my dad wasn't a blue-collar worker. He was a professor, and my mom was, you know, her grandparents were blue-collar workers, but she certainly wasn't. So I had to learn it the hard way, and I was like you. You know, we're of the age when there was no internet when we were trying to learn this stuff. You know, you had to go to the parts store, sit on the counter, yep, and listen to the guy with the gray hair explain how a set of points worked, because you couldn't look it up anywhere. You know, that was just the reality of it. So I learned at the feet of some great guys, honestly learned more sitting outside of Woolworths in Smiths Falls, Ontario at the cruise nights every Friday and Saturday night, just talking to these guys who've been building cars for their whole life. And that was where I started to pick up my whole sort of drive to do it. And then it just was something that was fun to do. And once you've found something that it's fun to do, then the rest is just easy after that.
Well, you know, one of the things that when I talk to people down here, and for people listening, I was born in Canada. Ian was born in Canada. And people forget, or they never knew in the first place, that the hot rodding scene, the racing scene, the off-road scenes up in Canada are as alive and arguably as active as they ever were in the United States. You know, I know you found that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I grew up, there was a mud bog race every weekend in my hometown, and that was just the way it is. And everyone was trying to get further into that mud pit, bigger tires. And that was back, you know, I put, my very first four-wheel drive truck was a Jeep CJ7, and I put 35-inch tall tires on it, and I was pulled over by the police on the way into town for driving a monster truck on the road.
Oh,
and
gosh.
Nowadays, you know, I got 35-inch tall tires on my tow rig, you know, so that's not, it wasn't, that was a, back then, that was a huge tire. So it's just, it's kind of crazy how much things have changed. But yeah, there's grassroots automotive motorsports pretty much the world over.
Well, one of the things that I, well, you know, forgive me for blowing smoke, but one of the things that I noticed the first time I saw you on TV, and one of the things that you and I share and that I admire in you and anybody else that has it, I call it the spirit of a teacher. And the fact is, you were literally a teacher. You were actually a high school shop teacher. So tell us about
well,
that.
Well, I got into teaching for purely selfish reasons. I was working as a mechanic. I'd been swinging wrenches on a bench at a GM dealer. I was a driveline tech. I was rebuilding transmissions and rebuilding axles. And I'm not a big fan of winter, which is kind of strange because I was living in Canada. But it always seemed that we were always busy in the summer and slow in the winter. So, you know, everyone's car broke down. Everyone's transmission blew up. So I was always working long hours in the summer. Well, I took a vacation, and I was sitting on a dock at my buddy's cottage. And it was summer, and I loved it. And I thought to myself, I got to find a job where I don't have to work in the summer. And then I realized that teachers didn't work in the summer. And so on a whim, I went and I talked to my old high school guidance counselor who I hadn't seen in about 7-8 years. And I just asked him, I said, you know, is there a way for me to become a teacher? And he just said, absolutely. There's tons of shop teacher jobs in Canada. And the next thing you know, a couple years later, after going back to school and getting my degree, I was in a high school in front of a bunch of kids teaching them basically auto shop. And I did that for another 8 years before I ended up on Extreme 4x4.
Forgive me, but that kind of sounds like an SCTV skit.
Oh, it totally felt like many times over. There was times when I was in front of that classroom thinking, this was not normal. You shouldn't go from swinging wrenches and then, you know, a year later be in charge of 90 lives.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny stuff. But, you know, obviously that has served you, especially in the how-to TV shows that we both are a part of. To me, it seems like it allows you to be able to focus down to the fine point message and to tell the long story in a short amount of time. Do you say that came from having to refine and do lesson plans and do classroom
curriculum? Oh, absolutely. You got to remember, a teenager's attention span is that of a gnat. And you're basically trying to teach them I was teaching 14, 15-year-old kids how to rebuild automatic transmissions, you know, and that's just not easy to do. So you have to take stuff and just make it incredibly simple. Now, when we start on the show, and you know, you and I have this conversation all the time, there's a fine line where you've got you can't get so simple that you offend the people who obviously know what you're talking about, but you have to keep it simple enough that the pros respect it and the amateurs learn something. And that's just kind of, you know, it's a fine line, but you can find it with just a little bit of work.
You can find it, and it's part of paying attention and paying tribute to the fundamentals. The fundamentals are that. They're without agenda, and you have to have the basic knowledge. For instance, righty-tighty, lefty-loosey. There's very few exceptions to that. And, you know, you can do it. I find the same thing when I coach people on how to paint cars with the Paint Education series and doing, you know, some of the workshops that I've done over the years. You assume that people know it, but you teach it at the same time as you're assuming people know it. So it is a bit of a dance, like you say, but it all comes down to the fundamentals.
Absolutely. At the end of the day, if you're covering the core competencies of doing something, then somebody who's never done it before feels more empowered to do it themselves, and somebody who's maybe done it before looks back, and they'll just sit there, and they'll be agreeing with you the whole time, going, yep, that's exactly what I would do, and that's exactly what I would do. And in an ideal world, I'm a firm believer that no one knows everything. And the first time you think you know everything, you're going to start forgetting everything that you've ever learned. We're all still learning. You and I talk about it all the time. You know, I learn something every single day. And the minute you say to yourself, oh, I don't need to learn anything more about this, it's a mistake.
Yep.
And that's why even these, you know, you look at the demographics of the show and, you know, and of the magazine that I work for and everything. A lot of these guys are professionals. You know, but they have that passion, and even there, they're still learning something when they watch these shows, and that's great.
Yeah, absolutely it is, and that just shows the character of the people that are willing to keep themselves open. And one of my favorite sayings I actually got from my wife, and she's a teacher as well, just with a different format. She teaches children, and you know, one of the things that she likes to say is, just because you give it away and show it to somebody else doesn't mean you don't have it anymore. And I live by that. It's because you can coach somebody without thinking that you're all of that and learn from them just as much as they're learning
Absolutely.
From you.
Absolutely. And that, you know, it's different back when I was training in Canada. It's a very European approach. You know, it's an apprenticeship program. You're not allowed to call yourself a mechanic until you've spent 9,000 hours with an actual mechanic who he has spent 9,000 plus hours with another mechanic. And it just, it's a domino effect, you know, and that's, you know, you're taught to learn. And then at the same time, you're taught to teach, and that's your job. It's your job as a tradesman is to pass this stuff on to the next generation, or who's going to fix cars? Who's going to build houses? Who's going to lay bricks? No one's going to know how to do it.
Well, in Canada, the U.S., we're rural countries. Let's face it. personal transportation is always going to be here. So there will always be a need to get yourself out of trouble in the first place. But aside from that, there's always career opportunities. Now, whether you're turning wrenches or, you know, have found your place in some other genre to where you can apply your automotive skills, you know, you'll never be without a job. My dad told me that a long time ago. So, you know, for you, with your wrench-turning skills, it's created an opportunity for you to where you will always, always, always be able to find employment no matter where you're
at. Yeah, and the beauty of it is, I've always said, I've been very fortunate. I left all my jobs when I still liked them. So when I stopped working as a dealership mechanic and went to become a teacher, I still liked being a mechanic. And when I left teaching to come and be on TV, I still enjoyed teaching. So I could still go back to any of those jobs, and it hadn't reached that burnout point yet.
And I've always said that if all this stuff ever dries up, I'd be just fine with going back to work at a dealership or a body shop and slinging paint guns because I love the work. And that brings me to kind of the next question. It's sort of like a how did we find ourselves here moment. You didn't graduate high school saying, man, I want to host an off-road how-to TV show one day. Tell everybody listening, and by the way, we're listening to and talking with Ian Johnson from Extreme 4x4 and Crawl Magazine here on Shop Talk. So, Ian, give us a little bit of background on the crazy path that you've gone from your days on Monster Garage to where you're at right now on Extreme 4x4 and
Spike. Yeah, I was literally sitting at home, and I still remember when the first Monster Garage show aired, and I watched it, and I was just in awe. And that was sort of the birth of, like, automotive TV becoming popular. You know, Overhauling hadn't hit the scene yet, and Monster Garage had just done, I think, 4 episodes, and they'd aired. And it was becoming okay to be a guy again. That's what I used to say, because it's okay to work in a shop. You know, you didn't have to have a pink polo and penny loafers anymore. You could actually be a guy. And I was up teaching in Canada, and, you know, the kids obviously loved those shows, and so they were always coming in every day talking about them. And I saw the benefit to the shows because the kids would come into the shop and they'd want to know, hey, what was that tool that guy used? Or what was that, why didn't that part work on that when we were watching that episode of Monster Garage or Orange County Choppers or Overhaul? And you could sort of bleed that into the classroom real easy, and it was great. So I applied, filled an application on the internet to be on the show just for fun. Didn't think it'd ever come to anything because, you know, I'm from Canada. You're going to fly me all the way down to California to be on a TV show. But I filled out the application, and then next thing you know, I got a phone call from the producers of the show, and they wanted to talk, and we sat down and talked about what the build was going to be. And literally within a week, I was on a plane to Long Beach and hanging out with Jesse James and everybody, and we spent 5 days building a Santa Claus parade float that was supposed to be in the Rose Bowl parade, but then it got banned because it had a dead Santa Claus on it. But it was just a fun time, you know, and I had fun, and it was just something completely different than anything I'd done before, and made some great friends, still friends with some of the guys from the build, but more importantly, I became pretty good friends with one of the producers. And about 8 months, maybe 9 months later, he called me up and he just sort of said, hey, there's some rumblings that there's this production company in Nashville and they're making these automotive how-to shows and they're going to be looking for some talent. You should apply because it's kind of up your alley because of the fact of my teaching experience and everything else we talked about before. And so I went online, found the application, and I applied. And it was very similar. You know, a week later, I was on a plane flying down to Nashville, sat down. There was, I think, 10 or 12 of us in an audition scenario. We all basically talked to the camera and talked about stuff. And then we flew home. And 2 weeks later, I got a phone call. And I literally the next day, I was flying to Nashville to get my visa paperwork all taken care of. And I literally left the interview. And 3 weeks later, I was all of a sudden a TV host.
And the rest is history,
as
they say.
It was all worth it.
Well, it's so interesting to me that, you know, you see TV and genres come and genres go, and this is popular, and the sitcoms and the evening tabloid shows are, and it seems like there's this cycle, this shelf life of TV shows that kind of come and go. Like you were talking about, it was okay to be a guy again all of a sudden. And, you know, I have a theory that the reason that our shows are evergreen is because of the content. I don't think it has much to do with who's presenting it, although that's important. You know, and not to say that you or I don't know our jobs. We do know our jobs, and you know, it's important to be able to communicate effectively, of course. But to me, information is king, and that is what has kept our shows on the air so long. What's your thought on that?
I agree completely. I was watching This Old House when I was 15 years old, and I still watch it today. You know, you look at a how-to television show that is engaging and interesting, and that's what we have, and that's what we do, and that's what keeps these shows on the air for so long. Like, there's no other shows out there that are running into their 10th season or into their 12th season or 15th season. It just doesn't exist unless you look at the world of how-to television, and that's just like you said, it's information. It's people want to turn on the TV and they want to learn something, have a little, you know, get edutained, as we would say, you know, taught and entertained at the same time, and they have fun doing it.
Yep. Well, pinch you and pinch me. So, you know, hopefully the horse will still support our weight for a while longer.
It had better.
But, well, listen, talk to me about Crawl Magazine. How did that come about?
That was like just a fluke. Crawl Magazine originally was called Extreme Off-Road Magazine, and it just had bad business model, and it just had some unfortunate circumstances. It was a really good magazine that just had some bad luck in the world of print when everyone was getting scared of print, and it failed. And it came back after that with a little bit of love, and three of us stepped in, myself, John Herrick, and Larry Nickel, and we just sort of decided that for the good of the sport, of the world of hardcore off-road, that magazine had to be out there. It had to be made and had to be for people to read because nobody else was doing it. Nobody else was putting, you know, hardcore tube buggies in print magazine, and nobody else was showing this backyard fab kind of stuff. So we bit the bullet and put the money into it and brought it back to life. And, you know, for the past 3 years now, it's been doing really well. Subscriptions grow on a monthly basis. You know, it's into the 30,000 subscribers. It's always been our focus to have a very, very good print magazine with very few ads in it, high quality photographs with good shooters, and most importantly, trucks that actually get wheeled, not trailer queens. You know, we want to see these trucks on their side in a rock pile somewhere, just bashed up, you know, and that's what the magazine focuses on.
Yeah, well, it's a good read. I'm a subscriber and proud of that, and there's always great tech. You're the senior tech editor,
yeah, my
is that right?
Job, basically, we basically divided the book up since there was three of us. We have a shooter who does all the photographs for us, and he's a great guy, Tim McGee, and he's just one of those guys who's meant to take pictures for a living and happens to love off-road. So he does all the photographs, and my job is to basically sit down and make sure the tech is still something that somebody who's walking out in their garage and going to work on their own truck it will help them do it.
Right, right. And I think that's a great mission statement. So people that are listening to this right now, how would they go about finding Crawl Magazine?
The easiest way, you know, if you're looking for Crawl Magazine, to buy it on a newsstand, it's always held in premium newsstand spaces. So you'll find it at your Barnes & Nobles or other bookstores like that. On the West Coast, we're in Checkers and a couple other auto parts stores. The other option is to go online to crawlmag.com, and you can subscribe to the magazine, get it delivered right to your door.
Well, there you go. Subscribe to Crawl, baby. It's a good book. Well, let me ask you this, Ian. You know, everybody is aware that we went through a big, giant recession, and discretionary income was shaved, and our industry shook. The automotive aftermarket shook from it. Billions of dollars were eliminated from the annual budgets, and businesses went away, and it was a trying time. But it was also something really interesting happened. The money got shuffled around, but genres that you would think would be completely discretionary income like, you know, high-end hot rod building and extreme off-road. Those genres survived and arguably grew. Hardcore off-road is stronger than it ever was, and we're just coming out of the tail end of this recession. What do you attribute that to?
I think the biggest reason that hardcore off-road survived is the fact that you can still get into it for that low price point. You know, there's lots of guys out there who, you know, are wheeling on with a $5,000, maybe a $10,000 truck. So I think that was the first thing. I think the second thing is the fact that hardcore off-road still relies a lot on do-it-yourself. You know, there are guys out there who have buggies built and rigs built by shops, but I would say by and large, it's still probably 75% of the trucks that you see out there are built by the guys who own them and the guys who are driving them. And that, I think that sort of helped lock that in because they're just working in their garage, you know.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And you know, as far as, like, you know my background, I'm a kind of a muscle car guy. Restoration is sort of my gig. Paint and body is what I cut my teeth in as a kid. And that's sort of where my passion and my heart lies. And I've seen cars like Camaro and Mustang and some of the Mopars go from the point to where you better hoped you got a good parts car and you didn't have to buy many aftermarket pieces because they weren't there, to the point to where it's just like a VW Bug in the J.C. Whitney catalog. You can pretty much order every single piece from the sheet metal to the bushings to the rubber gaskets and grommets from a catalog, and you can build an early Mustang. Where I'm going with this is that in your tenure with Hardcore Off-Road, have you seen a similar thing happen? Have the manufacturers stepped up to affordable and available parts that fit multiple platforms?
I would say that part of the off-road world is the Jeep world. You know, I always say that a Jeep is kind of like a Harley-Davidson, and that's really what I think carried a lot of the smaller manufacturers and even smaller retailers through the recession, was the fact that people still bought Jeeps. You know, they still bought a Jeep, and instead of going and running down and buying a lift kit, wheels, tires, and everything, maybe they'd go down and just buy a new soft top or, you know, spend a little bit of money. But they were still taking their Jeep off-road. But that's a Jeep. You can order every single part of a Jeep out of a catalog, including a frame. And that's what you can do. We've done it. I've done it on the show. I've done it personally in my shop, where you just basically order an entire Jeep and it shows up and you put it together. And that is, that's the sort of world that carries off-road always. And Jeeps are incredibly popular, always will be.
Mm-hmm. So in your opinion, would you say that for some guy that wants to get into wheeling, wants to bring a rig off-road, he's got some buddies with built rigs and stuff like that, if he wants to get into it, would you point him towards
Jeep? If he's never wheeled before, absolutely. Jeeps are a great truck for a couple different reasons. Number one, it's a good base vehicle, you know, solid axle front and rear, you know, short wheelbase, built to go off-road, but more importantly, built to still drive home at the end of the day. You know, if you really want to, just like if you want to compete at a drag strip, you're going to, or you want to win at a car show, you don't drive your car there. You put it on a trailer or you put it on a closed trailer, you haul it there with your truck, you unload it, you either race or show your car, and then you tuck it back in and drive it home. And we do that with our, you know, really hardcore trucks, like my two buggies. You got to own a truck and a trailer. But if you own a Jeep, you can drive it from your house, drive it to the trail, wheel it, drive it home. And that's the biggest
thing. It is. It's very, very cool. And I've been so fortunate to be able to learn from guys like you and guys like Ryan Shand with experience with Jeeps. And, you know, not my world. I've been wheeling in pickup trucks and all kinds of crazy bush buggies that we used to make back up in Canada. But as far as really, truly wheeling down in these rugged hills in Tennessee, I've been schooled, man. And some of the funnest vehicles I've ever been in are the easiest and least expensive ones that we've built on the truck show. And, you know, Cheap Cherokee and some other projects come to mind that we didn't have very much time and money in. And I've came out of the other end of that, empowered, thinking that this is something that I could do. And, you know, trust me, if you're listening out there, you know, not everybody knows everything all at once. You learn as we go. We've talked about that here. And I learned that the off-roading part of it and the Jeep hobby is attainable and it's accessible. And I'm 100% in agreement with you, Ian. I think Jeep would be the best way for somebody to go. You could pick up a Cherokee for, you know, $1,500 and just and go wheeling that day.
Yeah, absolutely. You could. And you'd have just as much fun as everybody else out there.
So basic skills needed to not to do a trail fix, but to do some off-road modifications. What do you need to be
basically
able to do?
Probably the biggest thing is the simple stuff is going to be installing a suspension lift, which isn't hard. You know, anyone can do that. You buy a lift kit, a good performing lift kit. Probably the number one skill that you're going to learn the fastest and have to get good at is welding. Because everything, whether you buy whether you put a roll cage in the truck or even some of your better performing suspension systems are going to require welding. So if you are planning to get into hardcore off-roading and you've bought your vehicle and you're ready to jump from, that stock Jeep up to something a little bit more serious, then you better learn how to weld and you better learn how to weld well. Because the welds in an off-road truck are kind of, that's what's going to save you when you roll that thing down a hill.
Exactly. That's kind of your lifeline. Now, speaking of welding, you've been a teacher. You've taught kids how to weld. You teach us all how to weld on the TV shows. And thank you very much for the welding tips that you give me when I run down the hall, by the way. Can a guy get by with a 110 MIG welder?
Yeah, you can get by with a 110 MIG welder. You just have to realize the limitations of it. You know, your 110 MIG welder is going to be okay for basically anything under 1/8-inch thick steel. Anything over that, you're going to be maxed out. You're not going to be able to make that welder. You're not going to get the penetration that you need in order to get a quality weld. So you're going to be able to do things like maybe some bumper mods. You might be able to put in some light-duty cage kits, but anything above that, you're going to need a 220-volt welder.
Right, or to borrow a buddy's. And, tools are accumulative, I always say. You buy the best tool you can afford at the time and then borrow the rest,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I always... I'm a tool junkie, so I'm bad for that. I have no problem with collecting tools. And, at the end of the day, I've never sold a tool in my life, and I don't think I ever will, because even at the end of the day, I meet so many guys who their hobby, and probably you have as well, they start with a hobby. Maybe they restore a car, they build an off-road truck, and maybe they were in a job they didn't really want to be in. And it just sort of parlays into the next thing they're running a restoration shop or running an off-road shop. And it's the tools they accumulate along the way that help them make that jump.
Well, as a professional technician, it's the tools in our toolbox that buy us back time and allow us to make more money. And when you're a weekend warrior, the tools, having the tool for the job at the time that you need it, it gives you back that time for your family or to actually get out and enjoy what you're working on in the first place. And, time is the one thing we can't buy. They're irreplaceable moments that we can never, ever get back. So, I'm a tool junkie too, but it's also for the reason that when I want to work, I want to be efficient when I work, not only because I don't have time to waste, but I want it done right. So there's a lot of good reasons to be, a tool connoisseur.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, man, I want to talk to you about something else, and this is something that everybody that has done any off-roading, certainly any surfing on the Internet about off-roading, has either heard of, been a part of, had an off-road park closed. We're talking about land use issues. Over the last few years, you and I have seen really good parks go away, and there's talk about some really big parks with us not having access to them anymore, and quite frankly, is pretty alarming. What's your thought on land use issues and those issues that are current?
Land use always, it really changes depending on where you live. People forget that on the west coast of this country, everywhere we go wheeling is public land, and that's just the truth, because on the west, everything west of basically Texas, there's the majority of the state is still owned by the government. And they have huge expanses of area that are, quote-unquote national parks or part of what's called the Bureau of Land Management. And it's government-controlled land. And that's what you wheel on when you're in places like Johnson Valley, California, where they have the King of the Hammers race, or you're in Moab, Utah, or the Rubicon Trail, or some of these iconic things. They're not owned by somebody. It's government land. And the fight that we have as off-roaders out there is equal access, and that's the hardest part, because the government doesn't seem to have a problem allowing horses and hikers and many other things, but the minute that you put an automotive spin on it, there's this negative connotation. And there's huge land use groups that are working to keep those areas open, and that is where your Blue Ribbon Coalition comes into play, some of your statewide stuff. You'll always find a national organization like Blue Ribbon Coalition, and then you'll find state-driven stuff like the Utah Four-Wheel Drive Association, and their goal is to keep that public land open to the public.
Well, and that goal is to educate and inform people to do responsible wheeling, to leave it better than how you found it, and to not leave trash, and to be very proactive and responsible. And that's one of the reasons I love the Blue Ribbon Coalition, and I think it's a very, very important thing to have around, a very important lobby.
Absolutely.
As well.
And I think for the majority of the people that you see on the trail, 9 times out of 10, that's how they want to enjoy it for years to come. So they want to preserve that land for themselves. And off-roading is a family sport. You'll usually see parents out there with their kids, and they want their kids to be able to go on these epic adventures just like they do. So they want to keep it open.
Yeah.
And they want to keep it clean.
Well, a lot of what I do is I coach people how to restore cars, and that's, believe it or not, that's a family event a lot of times.
Absolutely.
As well. And I get a lot of people saying, hey, I was thanks for your help on this technique or that technique, because my son and I are restoring this old Camaro just like I had in high school. Off-roading, I remember camping trips when I was a kid, and we'd go up and wheel and stuff, and that's as prevalent today as it was when we were coming up. And people forget that it's not just about a bunch of guys going and tearing up the woods and ripping the bark off trees. It's truly an outdoor sport where you can appreciate the outdoors as well as bond with your family and learn and grow together. It's, you know, not to be corny about it, but all those things are true,
aren't
they? Oh,
absolutely. I think that's the coolest thing whenever you see anybody or hear of someone who's working on their car. 9 times out of 10, they're doing it with their son or daughter or, you know, with their significant other. It becomes a family event.
Well, since you're kind of up on this a lot more than a lot of people, can you point our listeners towards a website where they could find out more about how to make their voice heard when it comes to these
Probably
issues?
The best place to always go is going to start with the Blue Ribbon Coalition, and that's going to be your national organization, and they will be able to steer you down right down to the local level. And once you get into the local level, then you're going to be talking to local clubs who get out and, you know, they want to go out and work on specific trails. They'll have work days where you can go out and volunteer and keep land uses open. But the most important thing, if you start it with the Blue Ribbon Coalition, that's our national voice that helps keep places open for us, and that's where I would send everybody to start.
I would say there first, also pay attention to SEMA PAC, SEMA.org. SEMA is very vocal in Washington and has a very strong lobby counteracting some of these crazy vehicle laws that want to get pushed down the people want to push down the pike, and it's important. Don't think that just because you're one guy out there that your voice doesn't matter. It does. It truly
Absolutely.
Does. Well, listen, man. Something else I wanted to ask you about. Hold on, I'm going to rephrase that. All right, so here we go. You're Ian Johnson. You're a gearhead. You're a duck out of water. Your family are professionals, and you're turning wrenches. You turn into a teacher, then you turn into a TV host, and now you're a magazine editor. And what's next for Ian Johnson? What do you got cooking?
Probably the newest thing we've got right now is something that we've just started this year, and it's kind of funny because everywhere I go, the number one question I get asked is always going to be, you know, I watch you on TV, I read about your stuff in the magazine, but what are you building? What do you wheel? Like, what do I wheel? What do I own? What am I building in my own shop? Stuff like that. So what we did this year, something a little bit different is, you know, we always joke, my shop's always kind of been called the Big Tire Garage, because every time you walk in there, there's always a big tire. And it's just my shop. It's behind my house. It's nothing fancy, but it's got the tools to get the job done, and we build a few cool cars in there and go out and have fun with them. So what we did this year was I sat down and I thought, you know what, I'm asked that all the time. I go to all these events to meet people. Why don't I bring my garage to the event? So what we're going to do this year is we've picked 5 key events. We're going to be at we're going to be up at the PA Jeep Show in York, Pennsylvania. We're going to be at the Crawl Readers Ride in Linville, Tennessee. We're going to be at the KOH Qualifier in Hot Springs, Arkansas, at the Super Lift Off Road Park. And we're going to be at the Indy Four Wheel Jamboree. And then we're going to finish it all out at the Dixie Run in Cookeville. And I'm basically bringing my shop. We're going to set up a booth at each one of these events. I'm going to bring one of the vehicles I've built. We've partnered up with some of the companies that I use in my shop on the projects that I build. I have some of their stuff on display, and you'll get to come and just sort of see what I got in my shop, what I'm working on, what I got planned next, and, you know, hang out, you know, shoot the poop, as I like to say. And
yeah. Now, is this something to where people can come and actually talk to you, or are you going to be just sort of displaying
there? No, I'll be there at each one. You know, I'll be there hanging out. I'll bring one of my rigs. We're going to have some T-shirts that we're going to give away. We're going to have people who are going to sign up for our new newsletter that's going to keep everybody in the loop as to what's happening in the shop. And then, you know, have some poster giveaways. And we've partnered with some key companies, Artec Industries, Savvy Off-Road, Metal Cloak, Pitbull Tires, and Trailworthy Fab. They're going to do some discounts with some of the guys that come in. And you want to come in and talk about the parts that I use on whatever build we got in that booth. And I'll tell you why I use that particular wheel and why I run that particular tire, sign a poster for you, and send you on your way and hang out if you want, or you can move on to the next spot.
Very cool. Well, that, I mean, you're hitting some big events, man. You had some well-traveled events and places, so people should have no problem finding you at the event. But have you got a website or anything like that to tell people about that will give them a little bit more insight as to this new venture?
Yeah, as soon as we start the tour, we're going to be firing up the BigTireGarage.com. It'll go live. We'll be posting on a Facebook page, Big Tire Garage, Facebook Big Tire Garage. We'll have that set up, and we'll do feeds from the event of what's happening. And the idea is just to get out there and just sort of show people, you know, kind of like Wizard of Oz when you pull back the curtain. What goes on when the cameras aren't rolling and there's nobody taking pictures for the magazine, you know? Stuff like that.
Very cool. Well, it sounds really good, man. I'm excited. I hope I get enough chance to break away and find you at one of those things and just get a bird's eye view. It would be very cool to maybe work with you on something like that at one of these, if I could be so bold as to
suggest
that.
Absolutely, anytime, man. You know, the whole goal of all this is just to, you know, get out, have some fun, show off some cars, and let people see the who's who of the off-road aftermarket, what parts get used and why, and just have a good time.
Yeah, very cool. Well, is there anybody else that you want to acknowledge or give a shout-out to or mention?
No, I think, you know, we basically pretty much covered it all. We've got Extreme 4x4 every weekend on Spike. You know, you can subscribe to Crawl. It's a great way to do it. You know, you can always find my articles in Crawl or Dirt Sports, or even some of the other Peterson Off-Road and some of their bigger magazines are always out there. And then, you know, this new idea we got rolling with the Big Tire Garage, I think we pretty much hit all the bases, my friend.
Well, very cool. Well, listen, I want to thank you for spending time with us today. I want to thank you on my behalf, as well as everybody else out there that's a knowledge sponge and an information geek and has the desire to learn, because you, my friend, you have the heart of a teacher, and it's an admirable trait, and I want to thank you for it. So thanks for that, and thanks for spending
time
with us here.
Anytime, Kevin. Always good to talk to you, buddy.
Absolutely. This is Ian Johnson from many different outlets, including Crawl Magazine, Big Tire Garage, Extreme 4x4, and, you know, anywhere there's a dirt trail, you're going to throw a rock and hit Ian's rig. So thanks for talking to us, buddy. You're listening to Shop Talk. I'm Kevin Tates, and we will see you down the road.
Thanks again to Ian for sharing his time with us today. And check out his website if you want to figure out a way to maybe meet him or go to one of these cool events that he's going to have his personal rig at. And pay attention to the Blue Ribbon Coalition. Get on their website, because these land use issues, well, they're not going away. And we want to keep these trails open, folks. This is family entertainment. And we're not destroying the earth. We're just riding up and down some trails. So pay attention to that. Until the next time, I'm your host, Kevin Tates. See you down the road. In the meantime, check out everything at the Eastwood.com website. Eastwood has what it takes to do the job right. And you know me, I like to do the job right. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk. I'm Kevin Tates.